Thanks for tuning in to Massive Music Weekend on WRCT Pittsburgh, and with that, we'll be returning to our regularly scheduled programming.
I need to pay bills. When is my tax refund coming?
I need to pay my taxes. What are my payment options?
I need to set up a payment plan. How do I do that?
I need answers to my tax questions. Where can I find them?
I need help with my taxes. Does the IRS offer free help?
I need a tax preparer. How should I choose one?
Need answers to your tax questions? Go to irs.gov.
speedy delivery. This is Mr. McFeely from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and I'm in Pittsburgh. I always listen to WRCT right here in Pittsburgh. Speedy delivery to you.
Thank you. is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we hear a very insightful interview about the likely consequences for the American people under the coming Trump administration. We will also hear about a landmark victory for human rights and the rule of law in a case we've been following for at least 16 years here on Law and Disorder.
It's a case brought originally by our own Michael Ratner, litigated successfully by CCR attorney, Center for Constitutional Rights attorney Catherine Gallagher, who hit the Khaki Corporation for $42 million.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Trump and his cabinet nominees are waiting to take the reins of government in a month, on January 20th. As Chris Hedges has said on this program, fascist Trump is a symptom of the disease. He's not the disease. The disease is neoliberal capitalism. If Trump was not there, it would be somebody else. Trump won the popular vote by less than his three predecessors, Biden, Obama, and Bush. He lost in 2020 and attempted to stay in power by a coup that failed. But last month, he succeeded in staging a comeback. He'll be more focused, more organized, and more brutal than he was the last time. During his campaign, he took full advantage of the people's disgust with the neoliberal capitalist Democratic Party and Biden and Harris. Her campaign emphasized joy, but put forward no real program to address their situation. 70 million people voted against her. Real wages in America have not risen in 50 years. The minimum wage has stayed the same, $7.50 an hour, for the last 15 years under both the Democrats and the Republicans. Half the country is poor or near poor. Most people don't even have enough money in the bank to survive a crisis. For-profit health care is so arbitrary and cruel that Luigi Mangione has become a popular hero, like Robin Hood, even though he shot someone in the back. Food prices have skyrocketed. Rent is too high. Home purchases are impossible for the average person. So is paying college tuition without going into debt. And the final insult was that Trump, the adjudicated rapist and coup specialist, has been named Man of the Year by Time magazine, which put his photo on the cover and wrote about his ringing the bell, opening the New York Stock Exchange, surrounded by his family. On January 20th, he'll be, in his words, dictator for a day. And then he'll start his program of mass deportation and retribution against people in the government that opposed him. Who are the people he has chosen to support this effort? What might we expect? We speak today with returning guest Patrick Martin, who writes for the World Socialist website. Patrick Martin, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today again. Now, my question to you is this. It's just come up that this bipartisan arrangement, bipartisan bill, really, that the Republicans and Democrats were able to come up with to keep the government open, was now threatened because first you had Elon Musk and then you had Trump saying, no, this is not going to happen. We want to change he wants to change the debt limit and goodness knows everything else. Talk to us about this and what the significance of it is.
Well, I think that the events have to be seen in the context of the whole six-week period since the election, because the radically anti-democratic character of the administration and how it's being formed has become more and more evident. Trump is proceeding on two tracks, which are parallel but not identical. He's testing out and disciplining his own party, and he's also testing out the institutional limitations on his power once he assumes the presidency, what we used to call checks and balances, but which Trump and the fascist right clearly regard as obstacles to be done away with. I mean, if you recall, he began, the first event that took place was the election of a Senate majority leader for the future. The most pro-Trump candidate of the three was defeated. And the candidate backed by Mitch McConnell, his deputy, was elected to lead the Republicans in the Senate. So that was initially a limitation as far as Trump was concerned. And then in the first round of the nominations, he selected a whole series of extremely provocative figures. And perhaps the most provocative was shot down, and that was Matt Gaetz for Attorney General. And they just quickly discovered that they had enough Republican defectors in the Senate that he could not be pushed through. And Trump dropped him almost immediately once that became clear. So he's been testing out the Republicans in the Senate and the Republicans in the House, and that's what yesterday was all about. They quickly proved that it is Trump and not the elected leadership of the Republicans in the House that controls the House delegation. Whether Johnson is to become Speaker again in January is now in considerable doubt. It depends entirely on what his arrangement is with Trump. And you've had various suggestions, including while it might sound preposterous as an indication of where we are at politically, the proposal that the House Republicans should select Elon Musk as the next Speaker. Because Speaker, by definition, does not have to be a member of Congress.
Patrick Martin, Biden called Trump an aspiring dictator and a fascist. When Trump won the election, Biden welcomed him into the White House and pledged his full cooperation. You've written that this is proof of the Democratic Party's cowardice, duplicity, and bankruptcy. Why'd you write that?
Well, look at the timing. The Democrats were increasingly using what one might sarcastically call the F word in the summer. It was while they were initially reluctant, they began to use it more and more, referring to Trump as a fascist. Harris said it, Walz said it, Biden said it. They all used that as an argument against Trump's reelection. Once Trump was the victor in the election, there has been not a single reference by any prominent Democrat. And I might add that the corporate media has stopped asking the question or raising the issue itself. There may be some references to his desire for revenge, for even a certain authoritarianism, but the question that he represents a specific type of politics, accurately described by the term fascist, which has enormous historical resonance, that has been dropped. And I think that that is an indication that for all of their professions of alarm, the Democrats are more concerned about the danger of a popular revolt against Trump than they are about anything Trump might himself do. They're more afraid of the people than they are of the right-wing forces that are gathering behind Trump.
You know, I wonder, Patrick, conversely, is there not more that Biden could do now to undermine Trump's obvious intentions to assault the rights of immigrants, the rights of all of us in this country during his administration? He's promised to do as much. Is there nothing Biden could be doing now to try to undermine that to some extent?
Well, I think that there are many things that he could do, but that he's chosen not to do, or at least on the running now when we're barely a month, or we are exactly 1 month from Trump becoming president again. Let's take, for example, the question of pardons. And here I'm not talking about the preemptive pardons of various prominent Democrats and Republicans who might be targeted by Trump. That is an issue. But I recall that I'm old enough to remember when Jimmy Carter commuted or pardoned an entire class of people, which was everyone who had refused the draft during the Vietnam War or who had gone to Canada to avoid being drafted. They were all commuted or pardoned. There was a blanket immunity. Well, there happened to be a million or so, perhaps more, Dreamers. These are people who have registered with the government. They are known. They were brought here as children by their parents. It was not a decision that they made. They did not themselves and could not be found criminally liable. But they have been. They're targeted, and they're now targeted by Trump. Why could not they be pardoned? Why could not everyone who is an undocumented immigrant be pardoned if they haven't committed any felony offenses? In other words, if their only offense is that they are present in the United States without papers, why could not they be commuted or immunized? There's absolutely no reason. I mean, there may be various legal technicalities that would distinguish one class of immigrants from another. But take, for instance, the people who are here under temporary protected status. They didn't commit a crime. They were allowed into the United States by the decision of the U.S. government. And it is widely believed that Trump will revoke that as soon as he comes into office, rendering them more or less after the fact illegal. Why could not a presidential action now change their legal status, or at least immunize them from the consequences of an illegal status, which is something different? In addition, there are several million people who currently have temporary protected status. They did not violate any laws when they entered the United States. They were invited in by presidential orders after earthquakes, other natural disasters. They are here legally, but Trump has threatened to revoke that temporary protected status, which would transform them into illegal, so-called illegal immigrants. Why can the president not do something now by executive order to protect those people against such a consequence? And really, this applies to all so-called undocumented immigrants. Unless they have been convicted of a felony of a different kind, if their only offense that they have committed is the presence, their presence in the United States without papers, something can be done from a legal standpoint to immunize them from the measures that Trump is proposing, the mass roundup and mass expulsion, along with their spouses, their children in many cases are U.S. citizens, and as Trump says cynically, we'll keep the families together by kicking them all out together. I think that there are many things that the Democrats could do, that the president could do, but they have shown no interest. The only thing which they appear to be interested in, aside from pardoning his son and perhaps pardoning some individual Democrats, is getting through additional funding for the war in Ukraine, the Israeli war in Gaza, and so on.
Patrick, rather than having a Senate exercise its constitutional power of advice and consent on the appointments that Trump is making to his cabinet, Trump is trying to put the Senate in a recess and make appointments without their advice and consent. What does this mean?
Well, this is an effort by Trump to override in slow motion the constitutional separation of powers. The Constitution was established after the American Revolution by people who had overthrown a king, and they wanted to set up a structure that prevented the return of any form of monarchy or absolute executive power. They made Congress, the legislature, Article I, that was for a reason. The president, who is set up by Article II, is charged with executing the laws passed by Congress. It's clearly he cannot be held legally liable for that. He cannot be charged with murder. So I think that the purpose of this exercise directed against the Senate, it's a test run for a government that will be really unprecedented in American history, that runs counter to the whole history of American democracy.
Trump is also, Patrick, floated the rather unique idea of setting up what he calls a warrior board. This warrior board would pass on the loyalty of certain military leaders for the purpose of getting rid of them. He's already made it clear he wants to court-martial General Miley. So what do you think about this? How dangerous is this? Do you think this is just some kind of pipe dream of his, or do you think he may be serious about it? And
well, I think Trump, first of all, should be taken seriously in everything, including his pipe dreams. He learned one thing from 2020, and that was that there was some institutional reluctance in the military, in the upper ranks of the military, to having troops deployed in American streets against the American people. This was not fundamentally because of concern on the impact of such a move on the military itself. An army which has been used and instructed to shoot down its own citizens becomes, first of all, obviously it loses popular support, and secondly, it becomes demoralized and less effective in fighting wars overseas. And they were concerned that the consequences of the deployment of the military within the United States would be very negative for the global position of American imperialism. So I thought that was their main concern. Now, his reaction to that was, first of all, after the election, he fired Secretary Mark Esper, who was one of the two, along with Milley, who opposed deploying the troops against the protests over police violence, and replaced him with a special operations colonel without the type of background that most secretaries of defense would be expected to have, but who was accompanied into the Pentagon by a man whose name is now well known, Kash Patel, who was his personal chief of staff, head of his office. And the job of Patel was to make sure that the military did not respond effectively to the January 6th coup attempt. And with Patel standing over his shoulder, Miller and the Army Secretary McCarthy delayed the dispatch of the D.C. National Guard beyond the point where it became clear that the coup had failed, that the local and state police were driving out the mob, and only then was the National Guard allowed to deploy towards the Capitol and finish the job of defending the Congress. But this was a very serious attempt. They have the House investigation into January 6th never probed the military in any serious way. But Trump certainly knows who was on his side and who was not. And that's one issue that he wants to take up fairly quickly, because the policies that he proposes to carry out, beginning with the war against immigrants, which he's defined as a war, he calls them an invasion, it will involve the use of the military. And therefore, it has to have military officers commanding it who are loyal to the policies and persona of Trump. So I think it's quite serious.
Patrick, Trump's announced the establishment of what he calls the Department of Governmental Efficiency, and they're supposed to be cutting the budget. I'm afraid that what they're going to do is cut everything except the military budget. Is that your opinion?
Yes. It's notable, for instance, that Elon Musk has intervened now into the budget crisis under conditions, but he waited, and Trump waited, until after the National Defense Authorization Act was passed by Congress and signed into law by Biden. So whatever happens in terms of the budget, they don't yet have the military appropriations bill, but they have the authorization bill, which is more important. That's been passed. That sets policy. They are going to cut spending. They won't cut spending in certain other areas as well. And let me give you the most important one. They will not cut the payment of interest on the national debt, which is now larger than the Pentagon budget. The United States will spend nearly $1 trillion on the military next year, or this year, the fiscal year that began in October, and it will spend more than $1 trillion on interest payments. And now you can guess who gets the lion's share of the interest payments, and they would not be very friendly if Trump was to cut that off. So interest payments will be made, the military will be paid for. What does that leave in terms of the budget? Well, the total U.S. budget is about $6 trillion. If you take out $1 trillion for the military and $1 trillion for interest payments, that leaves you with $4 trillion. Now, the goal of Ramaswamy and Elon Musk is to cut $2 trillion in supposed waste and wasteful government spending. That means 50% of all government spending that isn't the military and interest. Now, you cannot do that without cutting the biggest remaining spending programs, which are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. You can talk all you want about abolishing the Department of Education. That's a drop in the bucket. It's, I think, $80 billion. If you're going to cut $2 trillion, you have to cut substantially from the payments to the elderly. That's the only way to do it. And however they try to dress it up, that's where they're headed.
Well, you've characterized in general, Patrick, Trump's nominees as authoritarian and, or in some cases, fascist. I wanted to ask you about several of them. How, for example, do you evaluate Pete Hegseth, the head of the Department of Defense, or the person he's suggested for the Environmental Protection Agency and the people he wants to see on the National Labor Relations Board? What do you think about them, and what is their mission, if you will, if Trump does succeed in getting these people on board?
Well, some of the, I think there may be some differences amongst them. Hegseth is clearly a fascistic figure. He has longstanding ties to the ultra-right. He has extremely backward views on gender, on gays. He wants to, I think he's sufficiently characterized in my previous answer about the generals. He is one of those who wants to, as they put it, de-woke the Department of Defense. But what they really mean is subordinate the military entirely to the personal directives of Trump. Former Congressman Lee Zeldin has been nominated for the Environmental Protection Agency. I think he's a conventional conservative Republican, ran for governor. His purpose is to simply render the agency completely inoperative. They haven't said that they want to shut down the EPA, but that's the purpose. They want to eviscerate any agency that in any way impedes or regulates or restrains the extraction of corporate profit. Same thing with the guy who's the head of the Department of Energy. One thing which is characteristic of the cabinet, which is unusual by American standards, is its wealth. And I'm not just talking about Elon Musk, because that's another order of magnitude, but there are 8 or 9 billionaires besides him and Trump who are taking top positions in the Trump administration. So we have been characterizing this as a government of, by, and for the oligarchy. And I think that's literally the case.
Patrick, unfortunately, we've come to an end to our allotted time, and we're going to have to let you go. But before we do, do you have any further thoughts? And how can people follow your work?
Well, I'll answer the second question first so I don't run out of time. I write for the World Socialist website, which is wsws.org. It is the most widely read socialist website on the internet. That's my location. Okay, my final thought is that difficult as the current situation appears, one has to remember that the most powerful social force on the planet is the international working class, that workers produce everything, that the people that we're talking about are all parasites who play no essential function in global economy except to extract personal profit from it. And historically, their class rule has become a complete impediment to the development of society, to the safety of the planet, as we see in the climate crisis, to the health of the population, as we see in the series of pandemics that have come one and now there's another, and of course the overriding threat, and that is the threat of nuclear war. So the question is to make this vast majority of the world's population conscious both of the dangers that they face and of the enormous power which they can exercise if they do so collectively. And that's what we're seeking to do through the World Socialist website.
Excellent.
You take it easy. We're looking forward to having you back. We'll see how things develop.
Yes, thank you so much.
Glad to talk to you guys.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Last month, in a landmark verdict, a jury in a federal court in Virginia found a government contractor liable for its role in the torture of three Iraqi men at the infamous Abu Ghraib prison back in 2003-2004, and it ordered the company to pay a total of $42 million in compensatory and punitive damages to the men who brought the lawsuit. The plaintiffs were represented by attorneys from the famed Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, as well as pro bono counsel from Patterson, Belknap, Webb and Tyler, and Akil and Valentine. The private defendant company, acting as a government contractor, was CACI Premier Technology, Inc. The company was found liable for conspiring to torture and commit cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment of the Iraqi men, one a middle school principal, one a fruit vendor, and one a journalist. An attorney who filed this landmark